Okay, I want to welcome everyone to our fifth installment of our Rav Kook series, Rav Kook on Vegetarianism and the Messianic Era. And those are not always put together, but I'll argue this evening that really they're one and the same topic, that Rav Kook's vision of the Messianic Era is very deeply intertwined with this perspective, general perspective on vegetarianism. And that's going to be an interesting piece of our conversation. That's also, of course, appropriate as we've just concluded Yom Yerushalayim, and certainly the aspiration is, and the understanding is that our return to Yerushalayim, certainly we hope and pray, is that step along that path toward the Messianic Era. So certainly, as we exit this Chag, it's certainly appropriate to explore this particular subject. The truth is that the topic of Rav Kook and vegetarianism is one that always raises tremendous controversy. At one point there was some debate as to whether or not Rav Kook was a vegetarian. And people would say yes, and people would say no, and back and forth, and all these arguments, and one of these historical debates, and especially if you don't have any evidence in front of you, it makes for a particularly interesting conversation, because you can just keep on screaming your opinion, and no one has anything else to argue against you, and go around that way. But the truth is that it is fairly well accepted at this point. Rav Kook was not a vegetarian, and yet that hasn't sort of stopped the debate, it just sort of shifted it. So in other words, there are two competing views about Rav Kook's perspective on vegetarianism. As we've said in the past, there are two competing visions in general, sort of streams of thought in terms of the students of Rav Kook and what his legacy was and how it's understood. So similarly, when it comes to vegetarianism, there still remains some controversy until this day. There are those who say that Rav Kook is the great paragon of vegetarianism. He may not have been a practicing vegetarian, that may be true, but the fact of the matter is, according to at least many accounts, he was 99% vegetarian. He would eat just a little bit of meat on Shabbos, intentionally so, and even when he would eat in a mindful way. He allowed, and perhaps even encouraged, three of his outstanding students or students' students to become vegetarians. One was known as the Nazir. The Nazir is Rav David Cohen. He was extremely close with Rav Kook. He's known as the Nazir because, well, he was a Nazir. He accepted a vow of Nazirut and had extremely long hair and certainly no wine, the whole nine yards. An extremely, certainly charismatic and fascinating individual, very steeped in Kabbalistic understanding and wisdom. And among other things, the Nazir was a vegetarian with the blessing of his teacher, Rav Kook. The Nazir's son, who's still living, Rav Shariyash of Akoin, the chief rabbi of Haifa, is a well-known personality in Israel, and he too is a vegetarian. And of course, Rav Goren was also certainly a vegetarian by, I think, all accounts, and all three at least claim directly or indirectly to have been met with the approval of either Rav Kook himself or with close students who encouraged him in this direction. So here you have Rav Kook was a 99% vegetarian. His greatest students were 100% vegetarians. Not going to get much better than that, right? Right? You just had the 1%, but other than that, you are good to go. So, right, to care if I use these phrases in these times, you know, the 99%, 1%, etc. Anyhow, so that's sort of one school of thought. There are others who push back and disagree and say, wait a second, first of all, Rav Kook was not a vegetarian. Number two, Rav Kook actually writes explicitly in his writings that most people should not become vegetarians. That's considered to be inappropriate. It's a bad idea. He discourages people from doing it. He says we're not quite at that Messianic era yet. We're not there yet. In fact, according to Rav Kook, for most individuals, it's actually what he calls yuhara, or what we generally call yuhara. In other words, a show of immodesty, almost, to accept the stringency at this point in time. So Rav Kook actually seems to discourage vegetarianism in current times, according to some thoughts. Some views of that. Either some individuals who, with the blessing of Rav Kook, came to vegetarians, okay, those are three people out of, I don't know, millions and millions and millions of other people whom Rav Kook would have dissuaded and discouraged from becoming vegetarians. Not only that, but Rav Kook encouraged his students to become shochtim, right? So if they're going working in the shlachtas, that doesn't really seem to fit. So, you know, and so on and so forth, they go back and forth, around and around. So I gave you one example of this on the, I guess, lowercase conservative side of things, the anti-vegetarian camp, and this is Rav Shlomo Aviner, who certainly is a card-carrying, very close student of Rav Kook, one of the great products of Yeshiva Merkaz HaRav. So this is taken from his website. There are many English responsa that of his that have been translated there. So the question came to me, must one be a vegetarian according to Maran Rav Kook? And he answers, and refers to an essay that we'll be examining a little bit later on. Maran Rav Kook wrote in Kovetz Tzimchonut Vashalom, vegetarianism in peace. A vegetarianism is a future vision. Its importance is real, but not for today. Why not? Because it's impossible to skip stages in human development. Some vegetarians explain that they do not eat meat because showing compassion to animals is certainly important, but we first need to show compassion toward human beings. Right? Certainly we know of this critique of certain radical animal rights activists. We have not yet fulfilled all of our obligations toward human beings. After we finish being merciful and righteous human beings, we'll move on to animals. We cannot skip stages. We're not criticizing those who are vegetarians. If a person wants to be a vegetarian, he may do so, but it's impossible to find as a mitzvah or even as a stringency. Someone once asked me, I'm a vegetarian. I've decided to stop. Do I need hatarat nidarim, annulment of vows, since someone who performs proper custom a few times wants to stop must perform hataras nidarim? So there's no need for hatarat nidarim. Such vegetarianism is not a mitzvah or stringency. It's a good compassion and proper character trait for one who wishes, but it's before its time. An individual decides to be vegetarian is fine, this cannot be, as Maran Rav Kook refers to it, a communal practice. Rav Kook also wrote the same article, get this, vegetarianism can actually become a sort of hijacking of one's feelings of compassion. This means that sometimes there are those who are cruel to other people, but because their divine souls cannot bear this cruelty and need to be pacified, they say we will be vegetarians and be compassionate to animals. In fact, there were Nazis in the concentration camps who were vegetarians, and some even say that Hitler himself was a vegetarian. I believe that that's an accepted fact. I believe that also he was considered to be a great dog lover, and yet he was who he was, Yimach Shemo. So this is, I mean, the fact that he went that far and invoked this is perhaps, some might say, a little bit much. But you see what he's trying to argue. He's trying to argue that it's not just that it's before its time, but the final argument here seems to be that it can be used as a psychological defense mechanism for individuals who are actually cruel to human beings but feel uncomfortable with that, have a certain self-awareness of that cruelty, and hide that or cover it over through the guise of animal rights or animal compassion, sensitivity, etc., vegetarianism in this particular scenario, and Raviner calls them on it and says that that's hypocrisy, and that's just a defense mechanism, and that's another reason that sometimes at least vegetarianism is indeed inappropriate. So this is one example. There are others who on the internet who will respond point by point to arguments like this and say, no, Rav Kook is the great paragon, and here's why he's wrong. And they'll go through point by point, arguing to the contrary. But you sort of get the sense. And by the way, he quotes the Shochtim examples over here. By the way, I should add as well in this direction that Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, Rav Kook's son, was certainly not a vegetarian, and by most accounts was discouraged by his father from being a vegetarian. So you have some students who were encouraged, other students who were discouraged. It's kind of interesting. Maybe the answer is different students are different people. Maybe different people have different religious needs. Right? That's not unreasonable. Maybe there's a certain complexity here in terms of certain personalities who are inclined in certain directions, and Rav Kook will help to facilitate them developing different kinds of religious personalities, but not everyone's the same. Maybe Rav Tzvi Yehuda was a little bit more of a rational, halachic kind of personality, or something along those lines, whereas the others were maybe more mystically inclined, and this somehow was an extension of their mysticism, of a slightly greater detachment from this world and its pleasures. So maybe the answer is that there are different correct answers for different people, I don't know, but certainly the argument and the debate rages on in terms of where exactly to situate Rav Kook. So what I'd like to do is, with all that as sort of by way of introduction to this controversy swirling around, and a little bit of the background, I'd like to do is to do the following. As we're doing throughout this series, not just to look narrowly at this particular topic, but to contextualize it, so to situate it. And I'd like to do that in two ways. Number one, to look at some of the sources with regard to vegetarianism in general, which serve as the foundation for Rav Kook's analysis of the topic. Really couldn't do a comprehensive job without at least getting a little bit of familiarity with the basic sources. What are the arguments pro and con in terms of not just general literature and philosophy, but in particular with regard to Jewish sources? That's number one, Torah sources. And then two, before we look at Rav Kook's specific local views here, to sort of, again, contextualize that in terms of his broader thought thought, things that we've seen before, and we'll get a little bit of a taste of Rav Kook's ethics in general, which is going to be very important, and then we'll take a look at Rav Kook's specific text that in which he directly addresses this topic. So that's the plan. So let's jump in. If you take a look at the next page of your source sheet, source number 2, we find Psukim and Parshat Bereshit, and then source number 3, Parshat Noach, respectively. So what are the rules that govern Adam Rishon with regard to the eating, regard to his diet, right? What does God, the dietitian, as it were, have to say during right, during his time together meeting with Noach, so with Adam rather. So we find the Bereshit Perek Aleph, Yomer Elokim, Hinei Nasati Lechem Eskol Esev Zorei Azera Asher Pnei Chol Haaretz Veskol Ha'itz Asher Bo Pri Eitz Zorei Azera Lechem Yihyeh Le'Ochla. Okay, so what does Adam HaRishon's diet consist of? What you got? Right? What's he eating?
Grass.
Okay, good. Grass. Okay, so we've got vegetables. And what else we got on there? This is called Ha'itz, Asher Bo Pri Eitz, right? Fruit. So, fruit and vegetable diets. Okay, this is what my wife tries on me all the time. Unfortunately, she's still a work in progress. But that's pretty much what it is. As opposed to, by the way, the animal kingdom, L'chol Chayat Ha'aretz, L'chol Fashamayim, L'chol Meisal Ha'aretz, all the animals, Hashem Nefesh Chaya, Et Kol Yerek Esev, Le'ochla. So, that's interesting. What do the animals eat? Even less, if you think I have it rough, right? So imagine the animals, they're eating just vegetation. Okay? So in the time of Adam Rishon, it's pretty clear, black on white, humans, fruit and vegetable, right? Fruit and vegetables, animals, vegetables only. Okay? So that's what we got with regard to Adam. Okay, so now we fast forward to the ninth parak of Parsha Bereshit, and now we are in a new era. We are post-Mabel, right, post-flood. Noach now exits the Teva. There's almost a new world order. God issues a number of commands to Noach and his family. And in that context, God teaches him, Pasuk Gimel in Bereshit Parak Tet, Kol remes asher hu chai lachem yeh le'ochla. Right, all of a sudden, right, the animals are given to Noach for eating. Ki yerek esev nasati lechem eskol. What does that mean? Ki yerek esev, as grass of the ground, I have given you everything. What does he have in mind? As
just as free as you were to eat that.
Right, just as you had previously eaten. Right, you were limited to only things that grew from the ground. Now your diet has been extended to include even animals. Okay, so here we have
the first time these things. God has given permission to eat.
That's correct, right? Pretty clear.
Why?
Okay, that's a million-dollar question. Okay? Okay. What?
It's after tomorrow.
That's it. Okay. So, but
why? He wants to know why.
Wants to know why. Good. Okay, so that's what we're here to figure out, right? Isn't that? Don't you think that's where we're going? Right? That's exactly the right segue question. But even before we get to why, right, we have, and whether we're going to ask two whys, but even before we ask our questions, just to establish this as a point of fact, it's not just our reading, although I think it's pretty straightforward, but it's that of the Gemara as well. And as it's well established in Jewish tradition, there is a distinction between the respective diets of Adam on the one hand, Noach on the other. Gemara Masechet Sanhedrin daf Nun Ted Amud Bet 59b source 4. Amar Rav Yehuda Marav, Adam Harishon lo hutar lo basar la'achiva. Adam Harishon was not permitted to engage in carnivorous behavior. Dichsev lachem yeh le'ochla l'chol chayas haaretz. For you this shall be to eat. And then the next pasuk says, but for all the animals of the land. Right? So in other words, you're allowed to eat everything else, but not the actual animals. So it's pretty clear in Parsha Bereshit that no animals are permitted to be eaten. When the children of Noah came along, so then God did permit meat to them. It says that you're allowed to eat all of the animals. So the Gemara Sanhedrin indeed confirms this distinction, and so the question, well asked, is why? And I said I'd like to pose two whys, two questions, right, as follows. Number one, why was this the rule with regard to Adam HaRishon? Alright, and so what was the logic? Right? It's because did Adam Rishon have high cholesterol? One of my students suggested at one point, right? So this is a special Adam Rishon diet, right? What exactly is going on? Why, number one, was Adam HaRishon prohibited from eating meat? And number two, if that was the proper moral standard for mankind, right? So then we have the question, right? So then why the difference? So why the change from Adam to Noah? Two whys. What do you say?
Well, he's just getting started here. He's just the first man. Just let him start, you know, start small, and then eventually he'll go to meat, you know?
This topic always is a fun one. I remember I once spoke about vegetarian, not Rav Kook per se, but vegetarianism.
I mean, like a shy,
and there's
shy.
One...
Do you give children the steak, or you give them
the I remember once giving this shir to someone who is I think he's more of a religious steak eater than he is a religious Jew, and he's not the only one, so he's very serious about his meat, and I get up and I speak about vegetarianism and Rav Kook and all of these things, and you just see, it was actually, right around the time, it was Leil Shavuot, and like, you know, probably half the people are fast asleep, it's very late at night, but like the guy is, he's not going to sleep anytime soon, he's like, wide awake, eyes popping out of his head, he was not happy.
Is there something in the Kabbalists?
No.
That Noah was the first to birth?
But it comes before, right?
Not
before
the collapse.
Yeah.
But that was interesting.
It was true that he offers the korban. That's true, but it doesn't seem right. The question is, but Hevel doesn't seem to have eaten his korban, which is interesting. No. You have different kinds of korbanos. So, right? Korban olah is not consumed at all. Other korbanos are. It's hard to know. It's an interesting question. But yeah, it may be related to that. It is possible. It's a fair point, 100%. So let's start with the other mission. Okay, so maybe he's one step at a time. But that's possible. But the commentaries generally offer two approaches that are somewhat different, especially philosophically. They represent different kinds of perspectives. Some maintain that the reason Adam HaRishon was prohibited from eating meat is not because there was a problem per se in the action of devouring animal meat, as it were, but rather was in order to inculcate certain kinds of traits and characteristics within mankind, namely that of compassion. So in other words, if man is compassionate to the animal kingdom, not that the animal kingdom per se needs, according to halacha, according to God, to be the direct object of our compassion per se, although some will disagree with that in just a moment, but rather the point is that this is meant to inculcate, to discipline humanity to certain kinds of sensitivity, so that when Adam HaRishon would interact with his wife, with his children, with all of humanity that would ultimately come to exist, that he would do so with proper compassion, with proper midos. That's one approach. But there are others who disagree, and they say that no, that it's not just in order that there be sensitivity to others, but rather that actually animals are, despite being qualitatively different than humans, are nevertheless deserving of a certain degree of compassion, a certain degree of respect. And if you take a look at the Ramban, Nachmanides in source 6, he formulates the second position quite clearly. And he says as follows, V'hayazeh, in other words, this prohibition upon Adam HaRishon was for the following reason, because these moving animals, yesh lahem ktsat ma'alav d'nafsham, have a certain degree of significance or a certain quality in their souls, nidmuba, in which they are compared, levaalei hanefesh hamaskalet, to intellectual, in other words, human beings. The yeshlam b'chira b'tovasam u'zoneham, they have a certain degree of free will. They choose that which is best for them. They choose their food. V'yivrchu min hatzar v'hamisa, they flee from pain, from death. And quotes a pasuk from Kohelet, which is always a compelling argument, everyone knows. V'akasuv omer miyodea ruach b'nei ha'adam. Anyone get that? Ruach b'nei ha'adam ha'olahi l'mala. Says Kohelet Yeshiva High School. Okay. L'mala v'ruach ha'bema yoredet hi l'mata la'aretz. Right? So who knows the spirit of humans and animals? In other words, there's a certain degree of comparison. Or Kohelet is almost questioning. Who knows whose soul is, as it were, greater? Now, I don't think it means literally that's true, but the point is that there's a certain degree of commonality in certain regards between the soul of a human and the soul of an animal. Now, the Ramban is very clear. He says, ktsat. He says there's a qualitative difference. It is not the same type of soul. It's not the same type of bechira. It is not mean at all to equate between animals and humans, and certainly is an idea that is prominent nowadays. We touched on this last week with regard to evolution, right? And that there are philosophers, Peter Singer at Princeton, I don't know if I mentioned last week, who maintains that there really is no fundamental difference between humans and animals, and the great evidence is, or proof is in the pudding, and the fact that we are descended from the apes. So you see how evolution can clearly undermine the argument for Tselem Elokim and for the intrinsic qualitative difference between humanity and animals. The Ramban is not, God forbid, endorsing such a position. Clearly there's qualitative difference, and yet animals still have a soul. They still have a certain kind of quality and designation that makes them distinct from, for example, the world of vegetation, right, as an example. And so on. So therefore the Ramban says this is the basis for the prohibition against underation, against eating meat. Not just so that he'll inculcate that trait of compassion, etc., but rather because the animal is deserving of a certain amount of respect as such. So those are sort of two theories, although there could be others as well.
Is there anyone along those lines who says, you know, I mean, Adam Arishon had a direct contact in terms of naming the animals, right? So like, mm-hmm. You know, like when you do that, you have like a closeness. Uh-huh. You know, there's a certain closeness. It's like, okay.
Okay, and
I defined you.
Right. So I haven't seen that. That's very interesting. I haven't seen that. You're going to see that. I'll mention in a moment sort of the flip side argument, almost the inverse mm-hmm. argument with regard to what makes Noah different.
Right.
So that's all. But in terms of this, no, that is interesting. You could say that what an argument like that, or even the former argument, would allow us to say is that this is not necessarily an eternal ideal. Or it's someone who is, right, someone who wants to push back against vegetarianism, right? Who's someone, I don't know if it's your position or you're just playing the game a little bit earlier. But, okay, but if someone was a strong carnivore, right? Carnivore. So, such an individual, right, might argue, no. With regard to Avraham Rishon, that was a unique circumstance, or something like you're saying, or even if it was just meant to inculcate other traits of compassion, but it's not sort of an intrinsic value in its own right. These are different ways of sort of playing it down. So that I think is certainly true, but it's significant nonetheless that someone as prominent as the Ramban and others as well do have this idea that it's sort of an intrinsic value in its own right, and that it's really an ideal, which is going to be, of course, Rav Kook's approach, because he's going to take that Edenic ideal and he's going to replicate it during Yimas HaMashiach. So you see where he's, right? He's how it starts on one end of history and then it's going to make a comeback. It's going to return, according to Rav Kook, on the other end as well. You see where all of this is going.
I don't know if I'm making this up, but is there a medrash that Adam Rishon looked for a mate in the animal kingdom?
Mm-hmm. He
couldn't find one.
Did not make that up. Rashi quoted out of the Torah.
Yeah.
That's what that's referring to. And
he looked for a mate in the animal kingdom.
The Midrash actually says that he engaged sexually with, right? That's what it actually says, whether that's literal or sort of a metaphor or whatever it may be. But the point is he was engaged in trying to determine, okay, very good. Well, it's going to also relate to, we're going to talk about a little bit later, what exactly did animals look like at that time? Right, think Nachash talking to Adam and Chava. Just hold that thought for a little bit. That's something to bear in mind as well. Okay, so that's in terms of the first why, right? Why Adam HaRishon is given that way. But then the second question, right, is of course new, right? So, right, what changed, right? What happened, right? What was the transition between Adam and Noah? And here too, we have different interpretations that are offered. There's one perspective that's very unusual. I'll share it with you. This is that of Radak, of David Kimchi. This is what I was alluding to earlier, sort of the inverse argument from that which Scott had suggested, which is as follows. Radak claims that the reason that Noah was different is because Noah was involved in saving the animals through his experience in the Teva. He says, by saving the animals, he essentially gained mastery, or even ownership, as it were, over them. Because if you save someone or something, so they owe their life to you. So therefore, he gained a certain kind of kinyan, as it were, a certain degree of rights over the animal kingdom through his action of saving them in the Teva. That's what he claims. Seems a little bit strange to me in certain respects. He could have, again, made the opposite.
You could argue,
right, you could make exactly the opposite argument. But that is an approach that's out there. That's what Radak recommends. But probably the more common approach, and this is adopted by Abarbanel and ultimately by Rav Kook as well, is that it goes to standards. And the point is that Adam HaRishon was held to a higher ethical standard than Noah. And the reason is, right, pretty straightforward. Adam HaRishon was given the opportunity to live the perfect life, to be in Gan Eden, and so on and so forth. And quite frankly, he failed. And then subsequently, prior to the Mabel, all of humanity, unfortunately, fell very short. And so when God reconstitutes not only the physical world, but the moral order as well, God says, you know what? Because of the failure of mankind, I'm now going to demand less. Not because God didn't know, but because God gives mankind, as he always does, the opportunity to pass or fail our test, to prove ourselves, or God forbid, the alternative. And therefore, when he goes ahead and he comes to offer or to issue a new world order with regard to Noah and his family, so there are lower standards, and so he permits the eating of meat. So that's Abar Ben El's approach, and it's going to be a classic approach. And you can see what Rav Kook is going to do. Rav Kook is going to sort of say, take the far-reaching approaches here. Rav Kook is going to say, number one, for Adam HaRishon, it was truly an ideal. And number two, for Noach, it was reflective of lower standards. Those lower standards continue until today, and yet as we approach the Messianic era, right, as we, I think we mentioned last week, did we mention the inverted parabola previously? Right, that according to Rav Kook, you start on a high level, and then you descend, and then ultimately approaching the Messianic era, we go back up. So we can anticipate a heightened moral standard as we begin to approach Yemot HaMashiach. So you can start to see exactly how Rav Kook is situating this in his reading, not only of the ethics of vegetarianism per se, but really his reading of history in a larger kind of sense. So that's by way of introduction, in terms of the, not just introduction, but those are the basic sources, or the basic foundational, there are many more, but the most foundational sources with regard to vegetarianism. Now I want to turn to Rav Kook and to ask what influences in Rav Kook led him to be fairly sympathetic to vegetarianism, and yet not all the way. So certainly I would say that number one is his sense of the imminence of Yemot HaMashiach. He's curious what the Messianic era will look like. He believes that we're approaching that time. And so to ask himself, what will life look like, not just now in terms of vegetarianism, but in terms of how does now relate to the Messianic era, certainly is a question that's natural for Rav Kook to ask. That's number one. And we've well established at this point. Number two, perhaps even more interesting, Rav Kook, and this is a new thing we haven't explored too much in Rav Kook, but I think it fits right in many regards. And that's Rav Kook's very positive take on what I like to call, many call, natural morality. Natural morality. I did this as a two-part series earlier this year, but Rav Kook is a major advocate of the notion of natural morality. What does that mean? It essentially means that to some extent there's some sort of internal compass, according to Rav Kook, which itself complements the halachic system and revelations on and so forth, the Shulchan Aruch as it were, and also is a source of ethics. Our intuitive sense of right and wrong, according to Rav Kook, can be gauged, can be properly gauged, and should be looked to as a guide for moral and ethical behavior. That is not a common position. That's fairly radical, because what if my ethical intuition differs from that of someone else, right? And in a postmodern world, that's a very controversial thesis. Rav Kook has none of it. Rav Kook believes that there is an ethical intuition. Rav Kook says if someone wants to be barbaric, it's because they've skewed, essentially, that inner compass, that inner sense of right and wrong, that yashrut, that sense of morality. And Rav Kook goes very far. I'll give you just one example. There are many areas that are impacted by this approach. Take a look at source 7. So here you have Rav Kook's diary, Shmonak Vatzim. I remember, I think I mentioned that this was published, Rav Kook's diaries were published approximately 12 years ago. And something around that time. And I remember I was studying in Israel at the time, and the Israelis start running around saying, oh my goodness, they publish Rav Kook's diaries. The Shimona Kvatzin, these 8 diaries of Rav Kook have been put out there. They're available for everyone to use. The Israelis are like on like 7th heaven. It's like this amazing moment of revelation, incredible excitement all around. And they're walking around and bringing it to all the Americans. And the Americans are saying, Huh? Who cares? Like, I couldn't get when the Israelis are so excited about these desires of a cook. It was just like this cultural disconnect. There's just like this incredible chasm and divide. But the truth is that the Shemona Kvatzim are very valuable because they offer us sort of a lens into the inner life of Rav Kook. And the Israelis were right on this one. The Americans had a lot to learn, I think. We've hopefully come away since then. But the truth is that his diaries do have a tremendous amount to offer. This particular passage isn't so much a personal reflection, but it's very powerful. You'll see what he says. He says, "Asurli yirat shamayim, it is prohibited for the fear of heaven, shetirchak et hamusar hatev'i shel ha'adam. Never allow yirat shamayim, or what I'll call for this purpose, frumkeit. Don't allow frumkeit, and here I don't mean frumkeit always has to be used in a negative sense, but here I do mean it, according to Rav Kook, in a somewhat loaded way, in a sort of a negative way. He means it's prohibited for one to allow yirat shamayim, frumkeit as it were, to push away, to overcome the instinctive ethic of a person. Ki az eina od yirat shamayim tehora. That is not pure fear of heaven. Siman yirat shamayim tehora hu. If you want to identify a sign, a designation of pure fear of heaven, that is kesheha musar hativi, when the natural ethic hanatua b'teva hayashar shel ha'adam, which is implanted in the natural straightness, straight and narrow intuition of a person, olech ve'ole al piha b'malo yoter givoho mimashiko mi baladeha. So in other words, the natural morality is actually elevated by the Yirat Shamayim rather than diminished. If Yirat Shamayim lowers the level of one's sense of natural morality, of intuitive ethics, that is a problematic Yirat Shamayim. It's not authentic. Avam titziar Yirat Shamayim b'tchunak hazot, if one could imagine or conceive a fear of heaven with the following characteristic, namely shebelo hashpa talachim hayachin yoter notim lefol tov, that a person would have been more ethical, lo tzi alapol dvarim moilim laprav lechlal, and it's otherwise, without the Yirat Shamayim, there actually would have been a greater outcome for individuals and for society. The al pi hashpa atah, but because of Yirat Shamayim, mit ma'ikoh hapahu, there's less morality and ethics in society. Yirat Shamayim kazov hi yirah hisula. That is a disqualified. That is a Yirat Shamayim, which is pasul. Says Rav Kook, when we think about frumkeit, or maybe some would say chumras, and some sort of, sort of we all have this image that there's somehow, there's sometimes we find individuals who are trying to be machmir in terms of their personal behavior, in terms of their ritual behavior, and instead they end up offending others, being insensitive, just lacking basic derech eretz menshlichkeit. To me, and this is just a personal perspective, but I think it's halachically supported as well. One classic example is some scenarios, not all, but I would say many scenarios of davening on planes. This is just my personal perspective. I'll just be honest about it. I will say that the overwhelming majority of poskim say that if there's any chance, even a very small chance, that by davening in the aisle on the back, I will offend the stewardesses or anyone who needs the restroom, and so on and so forth, that halachically it's preferred for one to daven in their seat and not to daven with a minion in such a scenario, because although it's extremely important to daven with a minion, if there's even a chance that by doing so one will offend others and come away with a lack of mention, it's actually the overwhelming majority psak of all mainstream poskim across the spectrum. This is not dependent upon parts of the community, so far as I can see, that's a misplaced example of Yirat Shamayim or halachic practice. What that include? No. So in other words, if not necessarily. In other words, if part of their business model is that they're carving out the time and they've made arrangements and they've situated everything such that it will be done in a way that's menschlich, so then I think that's different. What all too often unfortunately happens when it's in other airlines where it hasn't been carved out of the schedule and the plane hasn't been situated in that way, and the professionals who are working on the plane haven't been primed for that, and so on and so forth, so then unfortunately it's a little bit of a different scenario. I'm not here to paskin, that's not my role. Feel free to ask your local rabbi, but I do think of this as just one example that I think about when we ask ourselves about the balance between Yirat Shamayim on the one hand and sort of natural menschlichkeit or morality on the other. Rav Kook doesn't actually write about the topic of davening on airplanes, so far as I know. What? It's possible. What?
were there airplanes in those days?
1935, yeah, that's the point. By planes. There weren't usually too many restroom options on the Wright Brothers original model. I don't believe that there's...
People will wake you up to make a minion. Yeah. Huh? People will wake you up to make
people a minion. People wake you up. Yes, Hoshina.
They don't think
we do
it, but they do have that minion look.
Some of us, they wake up like, did you put on Trillin yet? Like, do you have Trillin? It's the worst. Oh my gosh. Okay, that's the worst when people get approached to put on Trillin when they're wearing a kippah. That's always a toughie. Anyhow, so this idea of natural morality is indeed very central for Rav Kook. There's no question about it. But I think that it becomes extremely relevant for vegetarianism. There's Rav Kook views, and again, others will debate this. They'll say, what do you mean? How does Rav Kook know this? But Rav Kook believes that the natural instinct is to recoil from eating meat. He really thinks that that's just sort of straight, simple morality. God created animals. Animals have a soul. Why do you have to eat them? Why do you have to eat them? Why does God allow it? Because we have human weakness and human frailty, and after the Mabul, we lowered our expectations, and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, Rav Kook believes that, A, there's a notion of natural morality, and he believes an application that vegetarianism is such an example. Now, again, it doesn't mean that we're obligated to be vegetarians in practice.
That's a minority view, though. Right? Is that a minority view?
I think everything about Rav Kook, well, mostly, but certainly in this topic. certainly about his view, as we'll get to about the Messianic era, certainly that's a minority view.
So how does it relate to times when we...
It's a minority view, but it's you know what it's...
The base of Mikdash, and so how do you deal with
that? So Karbanos are difficult, and he will say that Karbanos, who probably invoked the Rambam, remember the Rambam has a famous position, the Rambam believes that all sacrifices are really not perfectly ideal. Right, someone invoked the Rambam in that regard. It's also a minority view. It's also considered a radical view. The Rambam famously argues in at least one place in Zmar Nevuchim. It might be more complicated. But the Rambam's view is generally presented as korbanot were a concession to human frailty. They really were not an ideal, and this was intended to move humans away from certain pagan practices. Ramban, Nachmanides, and others go ballistic and are deeply offended and have a visceral response. How could you say that? This is a positive vision. How could you say that such a central institution, Torah, is just a sort of this afterthought of the Yevet, just a sort of a middle stage to weaning people off? Karbanos are not an ideal.
It's extremely... What's going to be then?
So Rav Kook has plenty to say on that. That's correct. Okay, but that is it. But Rav Kook classically Rav Kook's view is tied to the Rambam. Now, as it happens, the Rambam doesn't go so far as Rav Kook, as we'll see. But some invoke the Rambam sort of a precedent for Rav Kook's direction.
But in terms of comprehension, in other words, of interpreting what is the meaning by eating meat, why is this so degrading? Why do we have to look at about it as philosophy?
Why is it degrading, or why do we do it if it is degrading?
How can we do it if it's what's defined? Not if it's a question of it's degrading. This is how you're implying that it is.
Right.
But if, in fact, this is the prescription that's given to the Kohanim must eat this, the Kohanim... Mm-hmm. So how could that be?
Right, how can that be? So that's an excellent question. And Rav Kook is not 100% clear. I do think there is a Kabbalistic philosophy that he endorses, which basically claims that by eating animals, eating sacrifices, we somehow elevate the animals. Kabbalistic notion, based on the Arizal. And Rav Kook does endorse this idea, that because animals are they're ultimately limited in their intellect, they're not the same as humans.
Using the intellect with animals, that terminology that I have a problem with.
No, he says they're
instinctual.
Right.
But it's not instinctual. Right. It's not.
No, Rav Kook is agreeing with you. Rav Kook is saying that they lack. No.
Yeah, but you're using the same term. That animals have... They're instinctual. It's totally different than people.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kook is agreeing with you. He's saying because they function in a way that's qualitatively different than humans, right? He says that by offering them to a higher cause, we somehow elevate the animals because they were not previously elevated. So this is, an agreement with what you're saying. So the point is that I think what he's saying is that it's true that this could otherwise be a base activity, but there's sort of an act of Kabbalistic elevation that takes place according to Rav Kook. So that could be part of what makes it appropriate.
The other basic issue is, when we understand what Basar and Dagen, or Basar and what it, and wine and Basar for a yantif. Mm-hmm. In other words, what is the ikar of a yantif?
Right, correct. So there's
you've got Basar is very
and as I said, Rav Kook would eat a little bit of meat.
He said he's going to eat some.
Right. Now, what's interesting though is that at the time of the Beit HaMikdash, clearly there's an obligation to eat meat. That much is clear. Whether or not there's an obligation to eat meat after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash is a subject.
Wait, hold on one second.
That is a subject of controversy. The truth is that some are makbid to eat meat, others do not. Shavuot is coming up, so most eat milchig meals and don't necessarily eat meat. The truth is the Gemara Msachem, in two places on the same page, the Gemara says that meat seems to say that meat is only necessary during the time of Yisrael Mikdash, is no longer necessary to be eaten. The problem is the Rambam seems to say that it is required, and there's a whole discussion among the poskim. The simple reading of Shulchan Aruch is that there's no current obligation to eat meat. So Rav Kook would say that was local, might say, I'm guessing, someone who is an advocate for vegetarianism nowadays would argue that that used to be mandatory as part of the sacrificial service. We'll explain sacrificial service, however, we'll explain it based on the Rambam's intermediary approach or this Kabbalistic approach, or however we explain it, but that nowadays it's no longer obligatory and therefore it could be consistent with vegetarianism. Others will say that no, that it remains an obligation of course nowadays. That's a machlokes a poskim and a halacha. That remains a matter of controversy.
But that, as I was saying, there's two distinct times. In other words, so we can go away, we're not doing the sacrificial. Mm-hmm. You understand that.
Right.
But we have a yantif.
So he's saying the yantif, you don't have to eat meat, some would say. Many
and
say.
Where is the comprehension of that, what I say, basar and yayin and basar is part of yantif. Where
do you get that? It's in the Zmiro, right? It's in the Zmiro. That's the question. Do we pass them from the Zemmer? That's a separate Rav Kook topic. We'll get there. So, next week.
You put it in context.
Correct.
The fact that there is
a long history, and there's a long history of Jews eating meat. That, I think, for Yantif in particular. Yes, it's true. It is true. Rav Kook would say that, Rav Kook would probably say we're getting closer to the Messianic era. And therefore we've become more enlightened. We have a deeper appreciation. Others would say, what do you mean? That's anti-traditional. This is where Cook becomes, again, controversial. Probably the majority of you would say that, no. If this is what we've been doing for thousands of years, this is what we should keep on doing. Right? Rav Kook would say, maybe there's new wisdom in the world. Very controversial. I understand. I'm not advocating. I'm presenting this as Rav Kook's series, so we're presenting Rav Kook's views. But you can see where others would push back, and fairly so. Absolutely. I hear it.
If you're eating for Yom
Tov,
it's okay.
All right. Yeah.
I give you that.
Shkoach. Okay. Good. Let's continue so that we don't get too late. I'm happy to continue the conversation afterward as well, for sure. So this is by way again of introduction to Rav Kook, and we'll see also there are going to be Kabbalistic dimensions as well. So I'd like to do now is take a look at two of the classic texts of Rav Kook. There are more, but two of the most meaty. Ha ha ha. Okay. Or anti-meaty.
no pun intended.
That's what I like to say, that every once in a while I have to justify my smicha credentials with a good old corny joke. So that was Yotze for tonight.
That's for vegetarians.
So,
that's what they do.
What? That's what we do. Yeah, yes, we practice. There's a lot of... Yeah, there's a whole... every Friday. It's an art. It really is an art. It's not just a science. It's an art as well. Okay. So...
Keep the audience...
All right, so...
entertained.
We laugh at ourselves. Okay, so if you take a look at this, the single handout, this is from Rav Kook's commentary in the Sidur known as Olat Re'iyah. This is a two-volume work, very beautiful, and shorter pieces, so it's a little bit more... It's shorter and a little bit more accessible. So here Rav Kook comments on the Pasuk, really Pasuk of Malachi, but we're familiar perhaps from the end of Shmon Esrei, V'arva la'Hashem minchat Yehudav Yerushalayim. Right? So the Pasuk literally means that it will be sweet for God, the korban, right, or I should say, the mincha, the gift of Yehudav Yerushalayim, kimei olam u'chishanim kadmoniyot. Right? Okay, so we're familiar. So, very interesting, because what's the language? V'arva la'Hashem, what will be sweet for God? Minchat Yehudav Yerushalayim. Right? What's a mincha? So some would say the gift, it's just a gift, right? But if you take it in a narrower sense, what's a korban mincha?
It's a flower offering.
It's a flower offering. And notably, what are we not referring to here?
Not meat.
Animal offering. Says Rav Kook, Hmm, that's interesting. What's going to be sweet to God in the Messianic era? Wheat offerings, flour offerings, right? Flour, right? Wheat, barley, etc. No animals. Hmm.
How do we know this?
Okay. This is Rav Kook. Now, this leads, and it's not the only source for Rav Kook, but Rav Kook has an extremely radical thesis, which is formulated here and elsewhere. So let's see it inside. This is one of the places. The animals which are offered upon the Mizbeach, this is what I refer to, this Kabbalistic doctrine, that falls upon them in themselves, hatikun, this elevation, or this fixing, through their elevation to become a sacrifice to God. Shekevon she'im bohem das, since they lack in right das, intentionality or understanding, einam magiim lihitalut zo, they only reach this elevated level, ki im b'maaseh ha'naaseh bohem, only through an action performed upon them, b'he'alut la'Hashem damam v'chelbam. When their blood and chilev are those certain parts of the fats of the animal are offered to God, shehin ikar machon nefesh, because therein, according to the Psukim, according to Chazal, that is the essence of the soul, and by offering the essence of the soul to God, the animal is thereby elevated. Masha'im kin ha'adam, whereas when it comes to mankind, Asher b'liba mithin yaskil ma'aseh karban, who understands through his intellect the action of offering a sacrifice, v'yitkarev al Hashem b'dato, and can become close to God through his cognition, through his understanding. Aval, when it comes to the Messianic era, wisdom and intelligence will extend not only to humans, but to animals as well. Remember I mentioned the Nachash? Right? So if he was standing, and he was talking, and he was arguing, he may have been wily, he may not have been a good guy, but he sure was smart. Right? So if that's what the Nachash was in the Edenic times, so what about the Messianic times when we will return once again to the area, right, to the something akin to the time of Gan Eden? So what will happen is indeed we'll have a return. This is a Kabbalistic doctrine, Kabbalat HaArizal. Right? They won't engage in any destruction. Why? Because everyone and everything, including the animals, will be invested with understanding. Says Rav Kook, in the Messianic era, we will only offer sacrifices of korban mincha, mihatzomach, of vegetation, that will te'arev Hashem k'mi'alam u'chshanim kadmaniyah. This is Rav Kook's very radical and highly controversial, extremely minority view. Let it be very clear for the record. This is not the common position. It's a very explosive position, indeed. Rav Kook claims that in Yimos HaMashiach, animals will not be brought as korbanot, only korbanos mincha, and essentially this is part of his vegetarian vision for Yimos HaMashiach. Okay, now, it's very interesting to note that, again, it's overwhelmingly disagreed upon. So I want to say that again, I stress that for the record, so that we know where Rav Kook is situated. I think it needs to be learned. It's a very important position. It's a very well-known position. But it's important to state when something is a common view, a minority view, and so on and so forth, and this certainly falls in the minority camp. That's number one. Number two, it's interesting to figure out why Rav Kook says this. Because there's sort of two opposing strands here. And you can, in different places, Rav Kook says two different things. Here, what does Rav Kook say? Rav Kook says, well, what's going to change is the level of the animals. Right? Or it's during time of Gan Eden, you have Adam and animals, right, in the Nachash like this. And then afterwards, the Nachash is punished. Mankind is also punished, but Nachash is punished. Agichon chateleich, right, etc., etc. This is a creepy calling. He doesn't have that intentionality, etc. And now we're like this, so there's a qualitative change in the relationship, right? And therefore, perhaps at that time, you could imagine that, right, that Noach is then permitted to eat, right, from the animal kingdom. But then, Hamazimon HaMashiach, once again, the Nachash, or the animal kingdom, will be elevated once again. Right? So according to this reading of history, what's changing, right, is not so much the ethical standing or responsibility that's incumbent upon humanity, but rather the standing of the animal kingdom vis-a-vis humanity. Right? That's what's changing. It's not humans that are changing or our expectations of humans, but rather it's just the animals that are somehow miraculously...
Well, we're changing, right? Too.
We are changing, but that's not... That's true, but that's not the point. The point, in terms of
animals
this...
Animals are changing,
Well, the point here, right, is that animals are just one second. Let me just offer the contrast. Elsewhere, Rav Kook understands that it's not because the animals are changing, but it goes back to what we said earlier, which is the ethical expectations of mankind. So that the point is, Adam HaRishon was held to a very high standard. He wasn't able to keep to that standard. So when it came to Noah, God says, you know what, at this point, forget it. We're going to allow you to eat meat. It's a concession to human frailty, but it's something that we will allow. But then when we return to Yimot HaMashiach, we will be elevated once again. In other words, we will return to the level of Adam HaRishon in Gan Eden, and therefore it would be reasonable to expect ourselves to hold ourselves to that higher level. If we have higher ethical capacity, moral ability, so then God will hold us to an equal and opposite moral responsibility. Right? So then, according to that narrative, what's changing, the key point that's really changing is not the animal vis-a-vis human being, but rather the human being's ethical capacity and ability. I think these two could be reconciled, and they all lead to the same place anyway, which is what? Which is vegetarianism, certainly in Yimot HaMashiach. I think that the answer is that they're both true on some level. So in other words, right? In other words, everyone, right? Everyone was elevated in Gan Eden, and everyone is elevated in Yimot HaMashiach, and in between, right, there's a diminishing, you know, status for both the animals and human beings at that time.
That's a nice theory, but yeah. There's no way.
You seem extremely perturbed this evening. What's going on?
Feed is me.
I'm sorry. I know. This is
No.
I don't want to come across that way. I'm just trying to.
No, perturbed is not a bad thing at all. No. Don't take offense at all. No. Go ahead.
I'm just trying to express myself.
You're doing it.
It's coming across that way.
It's not a bad way. It means that you're engaged and you're passionate about the topic. God forbid. Just the opposite.
Why did God want to have a carbon anyways? I mean, I don't understand that whole concept. Sorry to say that. But
okay.
Why do you have to bring an offering to... Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, it sounds so paganist.
Right. Well, that pagan, just plain old pagan. Well, that's what the Rambam. That's the motivation for the Rambam. The Rambam says it's a concession. Although I should say that the Rambam maintains that there will be karbanos le'asid lavel. The Rambam clearly is against Rav Kook, simply because the Rambam says that Yimot HaMashiach halacha won't change. So that's pretty clear. So you know, it's pretty clear that right. This becomes problematic for Rav Kook because. The Rambam was the one who was primed to say this. He already saw it as a concession to begin with, and yet the Rambam doesn't go all the way, so that becomes problematic for Rav Kook. So according to the Rambam, the answer is a concession. According to others, the answer is probably that it's symbolic. Rav Soloveitchik develops this idea. It's based on earlier sources as well, on the idea of sacrifice as the ultimate symbol or the essence of the religious discipline, that it's not just about finding meaning or being uplifted, but the willingness to engage in act of sacrifice, like Akedas Yitzchak, not in its, not in the theoretical result, God forbid, but in the willingness to do whatever it takes, no matter how difficult to understand, becomes sort of the great exemplar of what religion is all about. But just the concept of willingness to engage in an act of sacrifice, and this becomes symbolized or somehow represented in the act of sacrifice of the korban. So it's not so much the pagan. It's not that we believe that we're actually somehow, God forbid, satisfying a deity or something like that. Certainly not. But rather, it sort of represents this sense of again this symbolism of sacrifice. I want to hold it there just because I want to. I don't want to hold everyone too late because I want to take a look at one more text. I'm going to ask to... Well, I'm happy to continue conversations right afterward, if you don't mind. I know there's a lot to say tonight, but I don't want to keep everyone out too late. And I'd be more than happy to continue the conversation after this year as well. I want to take a look at one final text, but it's a longer text. I spent a little bit of time on it. And that's, if you take a look at the third page, this is source 8, and this is source 8, and this is what Rav Aviner referred to earlier, Rav Kook's great essay, Chazon HaTzimchiyot VaHashalom, or it's Chazon HaTzimchonot VaHashalom, Rav Kook's essay on vegetarianism and peace, and this is where he lays out his vision of vegetarianism, his vision of the Messianic era vis-a-vis vegetarianism, and it's a classic essay. It has 16 parts. It's available online if you'd like. I cut out parts of 1, 3, drop of 4, and 15, the last section. We won't read the whole thing, certainly, even what's printed here, but I want to read just to get a sense of Rav Kook's perspective. Andrew Cook begins with a fairly strong language. Take a look at this, and this goes back to the national morality discussion as well. It says, there is one branch of human, the highest levels of human development, which is positioned right now, according to the situation. What's that next word?
Kultura.
What's kultura?
Culture.
Okay, those are often the most, I find the most confusing words, right? According to present culture, right now it remains unfortunately in the status of this like nice fantasy. Right? These radical idealists, these utopian thinkers. But it's actually, says Rav Kook, a very natural ethical aspiration, the regesh hayosher nashi, which is consistent with just straight old human feeling, intuition. Simat ayin l'mishvatam shabalei hachayim b'imlo hamuvan, concern for the righteous treatment of animals in the fullest sense of the word. And then take a look at Rav Kook's language. Rav Kook was so embracing, was so loving to individuals, but didn't stop him from having a sharp pen. If he thought something was problematic, he spoke out. Very interesting. Take a look. He says, "Hafilosofir ha'achzariyot." He says, there's a branch of philosophy, right? Rav Kook says, there are all sorts of branches of philosophy, right? There's continental philosy, right? There are great philosophers too. There's Kant, there's Spinoza, and so on and so forth. Rav Kook says, there's another branch of philosophy. It's called the camp, right? The philosophical cruelty camp. Right, it says there's such a right. That's one of the streams of philosophy out there, right? The philosophy of cruelty. The otero tanship hakru, right? Is obviously tongue in cheek, but it's unbelievable. The otero tanship hakru vahag vahai, especially those who think that they have such elevated standards in morality. Al piashkafatam al musar nashim in kudara philosophia akwale. They have all these sophisticated analyses in which they situate local ethics within broader ethical theories. Hechalikula adam. They led humanity, each one in its own respective way. Lechanik bikirbo legamre. What's lechanik? Very strong word. Lechanik. Chenek. To strangle. Strangled. To strangle in of itself entirely. It regesh hayosher b'nogeh levalei hachayim. This natural sense of the straight and narrow with regard to treatment of animals. All this intelligence, all this sophistication, right? It doesn't get them anywhere. Rav Kook has, it's evident, Rav Kook has sort of an anti-elitist streak in his thought. Every once in a while he'll say, it's possible to be too intelligent, right? He'll say, right, Rav Kook, al tidchakam yoter. Sometimes it's possible to outsmart ourselves. We have an intuition, it's clear, it's straight, but we can sort of philosophize our way around it, right? So he says, right, lo hispikum lo yaspikum kol tidchakam, with all their intelligence, they will not be able to, l'shanot et teva hatzedek hativit, to change that basic sense of decency, asher nata yotzer adam mikirbo, which God implanted within him. No matter how burning, no matter how powerful that thought is, it is impossible for them to detract from our inner compasses. And take a look down, skip a line and a half, first word on the line, he says, V'chazal, he says, our rabbis, they didn't necessarily achieve that degree of over sophistication. They understood what was right, and they didn't veer from that. And our rabbis actually teach us that Rebbe, right, the great codifier, the great redactor of the Mishnah, ne'enash bi yisurin, was punished with physical suffering. He said to this calf that was going off to the slaughterhouse, "Zil, go." L'chachno tzarta. That's it. Go. I'm not worried about you. I don't feel badly for you. Right? This is what you're created for. He was punished for that dismissive attitude. Right? Because the rabbis understood. They were in tune with natural morality. And he was only healed because of an action. In other words, he did tshuva brachma hani b'nei karkushta. So he was kindly told that was the only reason he was healed, but really he was punished. They didn't follow the philosophers, and so on and so forth. And he continues, and he quotes the psukim in Parsha Bereishit, and the contrast to Bnei Noach. And if you jump all the quotes of those psukim, if you jump down to the third to last line in the first, on this first paragraph, Ume Atah, from here it issues, it emerges, Ha'efsharhu litzayer shetiyene evedet lanetzach, Tova musarit rabat erech, Shekvar haita b'mtziyot nachala la'enoshut. In other words, is it possible that a value that once existed, and it's going back to the time of Adam Rishon, right? This is Rav Kook, I told you, his analysis earlier. Rav Kook thinks that that was the ideal, and that Noach was just because of a concession, it was because of diminished ethical expectations on the part of God for mankind. So Rav Kook says, well, if this was once the ideal for humanity, so is it possible that that will be lost for all eternity? Obviously, this value on some level will continue. So he says, Aliyah v'chayotzi ba'ila ne'amar, esa de'ilim rach, that sometime in the distant future this ethic shall return once again. It will expand our footsteps and allow us to escape from this complex question. And he continues and he offers other sources that advocate toward a certain kind of sensitivity. And then at the end, if you jump to the last page, he actually, once again, I won't read inside, you can take a look on your own, the hour is already late, but I'll just point out that in addition to the points that he's already made about the elevation of animals to a similar level to humanity, and the fact that it quotes Ve'arvel Hashem l'chat Yehudah v'Yerushalayim, as he said earlier, he also points something very interesting out. He says, take a look at the beginning of Parashat Vayikra. When the Torah introduces the animal sacrifices, it uses a different term than when it refers to the carbon mincha, that of vegetation, that of flower. When it comes to the first parak in Vayikra, which is about animal carbonot, so there the Torah says, Adam ki yakrev, a man, when he offers an animal sacrifice, etc. When it comes to the carbon mincha, the Torah says, V'nefesh ki sakrev. Adam, nefesh. Why the distinction? So there can be a lot of explanations. He claims that Adam actually goes back to Adam Harishon, right? It's Adam. It's a specific Adam. Adam ki yakrev. So in other words, right, what are we saying here? We're saying Adam Harishon who failed. Adam Harishon who fell, who was not successful in holding himself to that standard. It's that same Adam Harishon, Adam ki yakrev. But if you want to know what's the ideal, if you want to know what's the purified, the elevated state, it's not the fallen Adam Harishon, it's the nefesh, it's the soul. It's the individual who's truly in tune with that which is natural, with that which is good. Nefesh ki takriv karban mincha. Such a soul cleanser of Kook will offer the sacrifice of the karban mincha. So he sees these two terms as sort of highlighting and reinforcing the theory that he had laid out. I'll just share a few things in closing. I won't read this inside. In source number 9, he becomes even more radical. He imagines the Sanhedrin, Yemot HaMashiach, reinterpreting Psukim, which is a very radical idea for Yemot HaMashiach in any sense. Again, extremely one of the most really radical positions in Rav Kook, but he imagines the Sanhedrin sort of rereading certain Psukim in order to explain Korbanos as consistent with vegetarianism. He even goes so far as to say, he says, how do I know this? He says, es karboni lachmi li'ishai. We lay on Rosh Chodesh. Again, very radical ideas. He's sort of throwing this idea. This is a personal journal. I don't know if this was meant as a final draft, but it was published as such, which makes it perceived as a final draft. But I don't know if it was intended as such. But either way, he says, et karmani lachmi li'ishai. So Rav Kook understands that pasuk. He says, and this is a kevet ha'echad. He says, If he says Hakitzad, Kol's bunch of Ali Chaim craving with Tashmish or Shut, Asay Bali Chaim the Gavoa. He says, if in society people are eating this, then you can offer it. But if people are at the point where they've gotten it, that vegetarianism is the ideal, which is where we're going, Rav Kook says, then it no longer applies. Again, you see this radical thought. I want to close with the following thoughts as ways of moderating Rav Kook. What Rav Aviner said is also true. I didn't reproduce the passages here, but Rav Kook elsewhere also stresses that although this is my ideal, we are not there yet. Rav Kook explicitly says that the average person should not be a vegetarian as man has said. Rav Kook may have been a 99%. You don't get that sense that he's encouraging the average person to be a vegetarian at all. You may get the sense that he encourages people to be conscious, to be aware, to be sensitive, to be limited, not to sort of just be just to be completely free, to be completely almost, you know, quasi-barbaric in terms of, or carnivorous and with all of its associations, one should be moderate, but Rav Kook discourages people. He says that indeed, that it's too far a step ahead, that we need to focus on first things first, that that's for a messianic era, but in today's world we have prior things to worry about. If we have World War I, and then after Rav Kook passed away, World War II, and many other challenges along the way, we may have bigger fish to fry, as it were, than, whatever, another bad pun, but you get the idea, than such things as vegetarianism. That is explicit in Rav Kook, and I would be remiss if I didn't emphasize that. And I think what emerges, and the way I would see this here, is Rav Kook sort of caught in attention. Because on the one hand, previously, we weren't at a point where we were close to the Messianic era, and it was clear that vegetarianism was not the right thing. And it's clear according to Rav Kook that ultimately that's where we're going, and that will be the ideal. Again, even if it's a minority position, for Rav Kook, that's clearly his understanding of where we're going to in the future. Right now, according to Rav Kook, we're somewhere quite in between. We're sort of getting toward the Messianic era, returning to Israel, we're starting to rebuild, we're building the arts in Israel, we're rebuilding religion in Israel, we're getting closer and closer, we're starting on the right direction, but we're not there yet. We're caught in this in-between. And part of the tension, I think, for Rav Kook is, so what does that mean for vegetarianism? So on the one hand, maybe we're closer than we were, but on the other hand, we don't want to get confused and overstep. Right? So again, what was his practice? It was sort of mixed in a way, and different students he's advising in very different directions, and so on and so forth. So I think what's happening here is that as part of Rav Kook's reading of history and his where he was situated in that history, there's really a certain kind of guilt and tension. Clearly what came beforehand, Rav Kook would say, we weren't on that level, right? Like Noach, that was previously. Ultimately, according to Rav Kook, yes, where we are right now, Rav Kook finds himself with some of that tension. So I do think it's kind of interesting because Rav Kook spoke about the thesis, the antithesis, and all of that, and the ultimate synthesis. In this topic, there will be a synthesis. It's not quite there yet for Rav Kook. He's still kind of working it out because we are quite in this in-between kind of place. The way Rav Kook settles on it is basically that there's a distinction between here and now and the Messianic era. Right? But it's not so neat, because, again, where are we at this time? So I think this is Rav Kook's way of sort of navigating his traditionalism on the one hand and his impulse toward that Messianic era on the other, seeing that on the one hand there's traditional practice for thousands of years. Rav Kook does appreciate that. At the same time, he has a very different vision in terms of Yimot HaMashiach, what that looks like, and Rav Kook finds that that tension is manifest in the here and now, and I think that can help to sort of situate and explain some of the struggles that we've seen Rav Kook's approach to this topic this evening. So I thank you once again for joining us.